This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Michael Tomczyk, sitting in for Mike Collins. You've probably had one of these moments in a restaurant, bar, or even your own home. You're with a teenager, or 20-something, chatting away, and you realize this person is not paying any attention to what you're saying. Instead, that millennial is staring straight down at a tiny screen and typing furiously on a miniature keypad. Hey, it couldn't wait. The millennial generation didn't invent ignoring you, but we've probably perfected it. In case you can't tell by the sound of my voice, I'm part of that generation, loosely defined as born between the early 80s and early 2000s. This morning, we're going to focus on how that generation is different from others, how it's the same, and how much that's tied to the world we're growing up in. Here in the studio with me are three millennials, Ashley, who'd prefer we not use her last name, and Scott and Katie Curry. Ashley is 25 years old and works for an industrial supply company. Ashley, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Scott and Katie are married. They're both 28 and urban planners. Scott and Katie, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
So, Ashley, where'd you go to school, and what did you think that you wanted to do when you were going to get out?
Well, I went to school at Lees McRae College up in Banner Elk in the mountains of North Carolina. Back then, I really thought I was going to become a zookeeper when I got out of college. Things didn't quite pan out that way.
So how did you end up going from, okay, I'm going to be a zookeeper to industrial supply company?
Well, a lot happened between graduating and where I'm at today. I looked furiously for jobs and really couldn't find anything in the zoo field. Ended up working for my mom's company for the first, 6 months or so right out of school. Ended up hiring on, starting in sales. I've been with Granger for the last few years since then.
And what are you, how happy are you in this job, and what are you thinking's next?
I like the job. I am pretty happy with what I'm doing. It's not really where I saw myself, obviously. What comes next? We'll see. There's a lot I have planned, a worldwide trip.
Oh, like traveling the world.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a lot I want to do for, just personal reasons, and we'll see.
Cool. And Scott and Katie, so I'm assuming since you were little children, you've always thought we're going to be urban planners.
maybe for me, actually. I used to build towns out of Lincoln logs. And so
cool.
I think from then on, even I didn't know that was a job. That was a real job. I just did it. And then once I got to college, I went to NC State for undergrad, and then went to grad school at Clemson and got my master's in city planning. So once I found out that was actually a career, I was like, I'm doing that. That's what I'm born to do.
And Scott?
I think that I was interested in the design professions from a fairly early age, probably back to high school. But I didn't always know exactly what that meant, whether it was architecture or landscape architecture. And I went to school at Ball State, which I'm from Indiana originally, and Ball State is a state school in Muncie, Indiana, and they have programs in urban planning, architecture, and landscape architecture. And so I kind of got a little bit of a taste of each of those and figured out that urban planning was really what I wanted to do.
And you guys do not work together, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
We do not.
Would that be too much?
Yes.
Yeah. A little too.
So, but what do you think of your jobs? How do you like your current roles and the companies you work for?
I like it. I work for an engineering firm doing transportation and environmental planning, and the work kind of changes different every day. I love the variety. I like changing between different assignments and kind of switching my brain back and forth. I think it stays exciting. I like being busy, and I think where I am right now, it's a good spot.
And Scott?
Yeah, I feel like I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing and where my expertise lies. Some days are definitely more entertaining than others. I tell my friends that, some days I get to go to work and draw all day long. And so that those are great days. I'm enjoying it.
So and when you're drawing, would you be like what would be an example of something that you're drawing?
So we urban planners focus on the design of the public realm specifically. And then
so we're talking cities, parks?
We're talking parks, streets, transportation systems. And really it operates on a variety of scales. So it can be anything from a large regional plan where you're talking about entire counties that you're looking at land uses for, or it can be something as small as a district or downtown plan where you're looking at, something as detailed as how many parking spots can we fit in this small district and how do you make the land uses work on a main street.
Okay, so a couple examples of what people our age are doing. And to get a broader perspective, we're also joined by John Della Volpe, who's director of polling for the Institute of Politics at Harvard University. He joins us from a studio at Harvard. And John, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So how much do you focus on millennials, and how long have you been studying them?
So thanks. So at Harvard, at the Institute of Politics, my entire focus is on millennials. And this is a 24th study we've conducted since 2000. And I think the best part about the study is it wasn't my idea. It was a study. It was the idea of a couple 19-year-olds, frankly, back in 2000, who were sophomores at the college, who were concerned about this kind of disconnect between folks who kind of in their high schools and in their college experience were volunteering in their community on a regular basis, but weren't as connected to politics as they perhaps expected them to be. So we've been focused on those attitudes again since 2000.
And so millennials are on track to become the most educated generation of Americans, according to the Pew Research Center. But with that comes a huge chunk of student debt. And I know that you guys have polled about this. So, John, how big of a deal is student debt to this generation?
It's a big deal. I mean, this is the largest generation in the history of America. 25% of our country sits within that 1980 to 2000 time in which they were born. And currently, 79% of people between 18 and 29-year-olds say that student debt is a major or a minor problem. Almost 6 in 10 say it's a major problem. And that's not surprising when you look at the fact that over 40% of all people are living in a household with some kind of student debt. And guys, it's even higher among college graduates. Sorry, Michael.
Oh, you're fine, John. And guys, just curious, I mean, is student debt something that you all are dealing with as well?
Yeah, absolutely.
Ashley?
Yes.
Yeah, I think we're blessed that we, Katie and I both don't have student debt. She was able to get some fellowships that helped her in grad school. But I went to University of Michigan for grad school, which was the most expensive public university at the time. I'm not sure if it still is. But so, yeah, student loan debt is a very real thing, real and tangible thing for us.
Gotcha. Well, and how much does that, I guess, impact kind of, you know, your planning as far as you're young and you're looking at trips and maybe you guys already have a house? I mean, how big of a factor is that in what you're looking to do going forward?
Well, we actually just bought our first home.
Congrats.
In November, thanks. But it was, you know, when you're budgeting to make that decision, you that student loan debt is sort of always looming. And so we knew that about a quarter of our income every month is going straight back to student loans. And so that really sort of puts into perspective, well, what can we afford and how much space do we really need and where do we want to be? And so it was definitely a big part of that decision.
And John, it's sort of hanging over like that. Do you find that's common?
Absolutely. It's not only common in some of the decisions that your guests have talked about buying that first house, but it's also common among young people who are thinking about what kind of education to pursue. So 70% of young people in our survey say that their financial circumstances played a pretty significant or an important role in their decision whether or not to pursue higher education. And it's a specifically a driving factor when you look at those who are in community college. 9 out of 10 people who are attending community college say they're there because of the financial circumstances.
And then, of course, you know, the idea of getting through college is to then find a job. So, John, from your studies, what are you finding that millennials are looking for?
Well, first of all, I think the lesson that we've seen from a quantitative research here at Harvard and from the qualitative research is people are committed to working. Oftentimes, we'll talk to millennials, and they'll work in a couple of different jobs and also volunteering in their community. So people really believe that they have a stake in this generation and making in their responsibility to make their community better and their job environment better. We find that about 56% of people between 18 and 29 tell us they're working as a paid employee. Another 5% are entrepreneurs saying they're self-employed. And the kind of qualities that they're looking for a job isn't necessarily to make a lot of money today. It's to have an impact and feel good about what they're doing. So that's kind of the best of both worlds. If they can find a job, that they could save some money, take down some of their debt responsibilities, but also feel like they're contributing to a larger purpose or cause.
And guys, I mean, for you, I mean, does that kind of nail it for you? I mean, what brought you to the jobs you're in now?
Well, I've been in my current job for a little over 4 years. And I mean, money obviously plays a role.
It's a job.
Oh yeah, and it's, I mean, you have to enjoy your job, which we both do. But the money for me definitely plays a role, because we both love traveling. You know, we have other things that, you know, we want to make enough money where we can put aside some money to go travel. And I think that's common at least among our age group, you know, the traveling. And
Ashley, I mean, speaking of traveling, so clearly you have very big travel plans. But
I
mean, so this balance of, you know, kind of getting out and looking for a job, and obviously money plays a role, but also something that you can really enjoy. I mean, kind of where do you stand with that right now? And is that part of why you're still trying to figure out what the next job is?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I feel like it's still early for me and just trying to find my place in this world. So really, I'd like to just take the time, at least for the next year or so, and save as much money as I can. And I really just want to get out and see the world and take a year or so, or however long it takes, maybe until I run out of money. And just really, you know, explore and learn more about other cultures and try to volunteer and, you know, like we say, you know, just make an impact. That's what I'd like to do.
And Scott, when you first came to Charlotte, I mean, how tough was it to get a job?
It was tough because I was geographically focused on Charlotte. Katie and I were dating long distance at the time, and I knew that I wanted to get myself down here so that I could be with her. And I think if I'd cast a wider net in terms of geography, it would have been a little easier. But I moved down here, took a part-time job, and sent out something like 110 applications and resumes, trying to find that first career position, and finally just banged down the Lawrence Group's door until I hired me. And it's worked out well. But I mean, so my decision was really driven by that relationship that I had with Katie and knowing that I wanted to move down here to be with her.
Yeah, and I think having that geographical focus, and I've heard this among a ton of my friends all over the country, it's almost become, because jobs are getting or were hard and are pretty hard to find, it's kind of become who you know and your connections. And so I remember Scott, you know, before he had a full-time job, he was going to all these different networking events and just getting out there because it did seem to be the real only way to get a job a few years ago is who you know and how they can help you.
And I want to give some quick perspective on just kind of youth unemployment. So in the U.S. last year, according to the Federal Reserve, youth unemployment was 16%. And the Federal Reserve has found that the youth unemployment rate has historically been about twice the total unemployment rate. And that's where it is right now, based on the latest Fed data. So in other words, youth unemployment is high. It's tough to find jobs out there. But the rate is not any higher than you'd expect it to be based on how it usually compares to the total unemployment rate. So just a little kind of nugget there for you. John, kind of shifting gears a little bit, how do millennials compare to other generations with political engagement and voter turnout?
Overall, this generation has overall, since 2000, we saw significant increases in participation relative to the elections beforehand. 2002, 2004, 2006, and 2008, we saw increased levels of participation. And it's I make a very clear argument to say that if it wasn't for young people, Hillary Clinton would likely be president today, not Barack Obama, based on their turnout and their share of vote that they showed to Obama all the way back to the Iowa caucus in 2008. However, having said that, the last couple of cycles we've seen youth participation fall back a little bit, not because they don't care about the country, but because they're disconnected from politics.
So, John Della Volpe of Harvard, thank you so much for joining us. We need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear from the journalist who wrote Time Magazine's cover story on millennials this summer. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
It's 9:20, and you're tuned to Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, where support comes from WFAE members and World Vision, striving to bring lasting change to children in need through education, health, nutrition, clean water, and economic development. World Vision believes in children. More at worldvision.org. And from Charlie Soap, makers of hypoallergenic, biodegradable laundry powder, liquid, and household cleaners. Made in North Carolina, available at the Fresh Market and charliesoap.com. Monday on Charlotte Talks, many people choose to give to nonprofits and charities during the holiday season, but not all charitable organizations are run efficiently. Our guests Monday keep an eye on charitable groups to make sure they are putting donations to the best use, are run with integrity, and serve the purpose they claim to. Join us for a discussion on the good and bad side of charities. That's when Charlotte Talks, Monday at 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Prodi News Roundup. A presidential panel recommends the NSA not be allowed to collect and store Americans' phone data. The Senate approves a 2-year budget deal, and outgoing Fed Chair Ben Bernanke says the stimulus program will gradually end next year.
Join the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show coming up at 10 on 90.7 WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk, sitting in for Mike Collins. So Time Magazine columnist Joel Stein has seen some odd interactions between millennials, those born between the early 80s and early 2000s.
I was at a restaurant in Charlotte Airport, and this girl was texting, was crying. It was her friend, and two moms. I don't know where they're going. One girl is crying, right? And the other girl is texting. They're obviously good friends. And I'm like, that's weird. But in general, that was after the article came out anyway.
The article Stein is talking about is his cover story in Time this summer called The Me Generation. Subtitle, Millennials Are Lazy, Entitled Narcissists Who Still Live With Their Parents, Why They'll Save Us All. Stein joined us earlier this week to discuss his contribution to the countless articles penned about millennials. I asked him why the media seems so obsessed with this generation.
Yeah, I mean, this happens to most generations. This happens to baby boomers. This happened to Generation X. But this is a particularly large group of people, being the echo of the baby boomer. And B, there's just this big technological change that just occurred. And people are still wrapping their heads around that, both for millennials and for everyone else. I mean, everyone's texting all the time, but millennials are growing up with it. So I think we're just fascinated that they're growing up in a very different world than the previous generation.
So when I started reading your cover story, my initial thought was, here we go again, more millennial bashing, although I would say that yours is probably the funniest of the millennial bashing that I've seen. But let's start with that. So of all the research you did, what negative things about millennials stood out most?
So many things. Many of them are just trends that have been going on since the Enlightenment, or at least Freud. Obviously, the things that people talk about are kind of proven in studies, which is the entitlement, which really annoys people, but I see that as a good and bad thing. What else stood out a lot? The narcissism stood out tremendously.
Yeah, you had a stat in there. Narcissistic personality disorder is nearly 3 times as high for millennials. That seems crazy to me.
It does seem crazy. But if you look at what's acceptable in our society now compared to, I'm 42, compared to when I grew up, it's weird. I mean, reality shows are basically documentaries about people with narcissistic personality disorder. the way it's acceptable to kind of brag about yourself and to brand yourself, like these are things you would joke about that were starting to emerge, to be honest, when I was growing up. This novelist I liked, Mark Lehner, used to kind of hilariously parody it. I kind of was parodying it in my columns, but I was self-aware and kind of knew it wasn't okay. And now those things are said not ironically, like branding yourself. Like that's a totally legitimate thing.
Which gets to another point that you raised, which is that this generation is just obsessed with fame. Like we would rather be famous than, be in Congress.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because it's quantifiable. When my parents were growing up, there was famous people and not famous people. And certainly there were some people who are a little more famous, but now everyone's fame is quantifiable through their, clout score and how many Twitter followers they have and how many Facebook friends they have. Like, instead of just knowing kind of that girl's more popular in high school, you can now kind of prove it.
Right, who has more friends on yeah. Facebook and who has more, like, Instagram posts.
Yeah, yeah, and so fame is really important. And a legitimate thing to strive for, because you can be a micro celebrity, and that has tangible benefits. If you have a bunch of people watching you on YouTube, but you're not famous in the traditional sense, you still get a lot of like cool stuff and a lot of ego gratification, and it's very competitive.
So there are also just a couple different details in your story that just really stick with me, like how 1950s families would have just a couple photos in their home. while American families today walk amid 85 pictures of themselves and all their pets. How'd you decide which details or images to use to kind of make your points and highlight these differences?
You know, we had such limited space, which is a bummer, because me and this guy, Josh Sanborn, mostly him, reported this for about a year, and I've had so much to read, and so many great studies. And, you know, first of all, I had to kind of convince the reader that generations are different from each other. Because everyone's response is, well, that's how people in their 20s are like. You're failing to compare them to people in the past who were in their 20s. And I had to say, no, I mean, there's a whole field that studies exactly that and takes that into account. And people from different generations are as different from each other as people from different countries. The time you grow up in really shapes who you are and what you find acceptable. And morality changes. It's not just technology. So there was just a lot of space we had to use just to prove that. And then there that stat, the one about photos, I actually got working on a different column. There's this sociologist at UCLA went to a bunch of houses, middle-class houses in L.A., and did, like, sociology and archaeology to them. And they printed this book with these amazing pictures and these amazing stats. And one of the things that freaked me out in that book was the amount of photos we all have of ourselves that we're kind of so proudly. It's a weird thing to be really proudly displaying a picture of yourself in your own house. And then I was also just interested in the fact that I have a 4-year-old son, and the amount of photos I have of him on a daily basis. I mean, I'm recording him in a way that, like, royalty was not recorded, you know, in the 18th century. You know, royalty had a bunch of portraits, but not every day. So, yeah, I don't know what that does to you. I don't know how that affects you to know that you are. And I thought of that because I was in New York in Washington Square Park, and I noticed a really young person posing like a celebrity somewhere, and a bunch of people taking his picture of his friends with. And I thought, oh, we're all doing that all day long. That's weird.
And certainly I think this generation does have to take responsibility for the selfie, which is maybe one of the most ridiculous things that we can contribute to modern society right now.
Yeah, but this is all moving so fast. We're all trying to, like, get a grasp on what is acceptable and what is unacceptable. You know, talking on your phone in public was unacceptable, you know, in 1997. Which isn't that long ago. The selfie, I mean, it was totally unacceptable 2 years ago. I think we're past the point in which that's even a bad thing. And it's a weird step in society to say that it's okay to want a picture of yourself. It's weird. I mean, people do it all the time. Take a picture of me. It's not that different, but it's a big step if in narcissism.
So also, you know, you lay out kind of all of these things. We've got the narcissism, the laziness, whatever else. And then your story has this turn when you then go through the ways that millennials shape up really well compared to other generations and how you can really relate to a lot of the things that they get criticized for. Which of those examples really stick with you?
Oh, well, you know, I completely relate to this generation as someone who's been writing a column about myself since I was in college. And the whole idea of being entitled really struck me because I didn't want to work my way up. You know, the path, at least it used to be for journalism, when I was starting, was you go to a small paper, work your way up to a bigger paper. And I just wanted to write a column right away about myself. And I was going to go to New York and find a magazine that was going to let me do that. And to be honest, if I had gone the other path, I don't know if it would have worked out the way I wanted it to. So the idea, especially now that there's so much access to being published or having, you know, your app out there, or that the barriers to entry are so low that being entitled makes sense to me. You know, trying to work your way up a ladder that doesn't exist in a corporation that might not be there is insanity. So it's not an illogical step. And in some ways, it's psychologically healthy to have that kind of confidence. And it certainly leads to a more creative world where people in their 20s can create lots of cool things. The downside is most people aren't going to succeed. And what what happens when they, after being told how awesome they are their whole life, in their mid to late 20s or early 30s, realize that they're not really going anywhere on their own and have to go work for other people.
Yeah. And that gets at this idea that you also raise about how some of what's going on for this generation is sort of a crisis of unmet expectations. It's like we're told we're special and we're beautiful and we're so smart, and then we get out in the real world and it's like, all right, what can you do for me?
Yeah, that was, interestingly enough, all a reaction to a study that said that kids with high self-esteem succeed. Now, unfortunately, you have to actually earn that self-esteem for it to work, which no one kind of knew in the 70s. So when I was growing up, that's when all the self-esteem stuff started to kick in. It wasn't necessarily for millennials. It was really for Generation X. You know, all this, we started with not quite as much, but the trophy for everyone for participating and telling everyone that they're great. And that had some negative effects. It had some positive effects too, but it definitely started to cause this narcissism and this expectation of success all the time.
So one thing I want to challenge from your story. You say
you wouldn't be a millennial if you were not doing that.
Fair enough. Okay, so at one point you say millennials have trouble understanding others' points of view. Now, I would argue that the generation before us that's running Congress right now has a bit of a hard time with that as well.
Yeah. Imagine when you guys run Congress.
Oh, it'd be a disaster. It'd be a disaster.
The one thing that millennials are good at as far as understanding other people's perspective is, having grown up, not just in America, but especially in America, but having grown up in a diverse global environment, just much more accepting of people's differences, which is a huge difference and a really positive one. Whether that's a simple thing as far as someone's sexuality or their race, but also just more complex versions of diversity. Like when I was growing up, there were goths and there were, we divided the high school very cleanly. Whereas now I feel like there's a lot, partly because of the internet, and you can go on and find out, oh, I'm goth, but I also am part of this NASCAR group. Like, I feel like people are allowed to be a little, even though they're branding themselves to the world much, much more simply, when they're in their actual social interactions in their own world, I feel like they allow for more complexity.
And that sense of branding, I mean, you mentioned it repeatedly with the internet. We have this way to connect to other people instantly all over the world that is something that no previous generation has grown up with.
Yeah, and it's forcing people to figure out what their brand is and how to market themselves. It's really weird to try and boil yourself down to a simple slogan, and that's part of what you have to do online. And what you have to do on Facebook, of course, to get likes and to get attention, is to tell people how awesome your life is. And when other people are consuming other people's awesomeness all day, and they start to think that their lives don't match up, that's also a problem.
One of the things that I wanted to discuss with you as well, just because you've done so much research on this, is, are millennials really that different from previous generations? And how much are those differences just a result of when they're coming of age during a technology boom and an economic bust?
Yeah, I wish I'd done a better job explaining this in the article. Every generation is really different from each other. And it's not just technology. There's those scenes, though they're in Mad Men, but you can also just watch, any newscast from the 1960s, especially if they have a shot of a street in New York City, and you see people in their mid-20s with, like, mustaches and jeans, and then you see people in their, like, 30s with a suit and a hat and a clean-shaven face, and that's not technology. That's a change that happened, and that change didn't then reverse itself when those people grew up. They didn't put on hats and those. They kept their jeans. They kept their rock and roll. That's a real change in attitude. The Enlightenment was a real change in attitude. Every generation is different from each other, not just because of technology, just because of how thought changes and how morality changes. So people in their 20s are different than people in their 20s before them. Probably, they're more different than Generation X, but they're even more different than boomers, and they're certainly more different than the greatest generation. There's probably a bigger change there even. So this isn't just about being in your 20s. everyone who studies this, and this is a real thing that people study in universities, they factor that out. So it's not, some of it is just what it's like to be in your 20s, but that's not what I was talking about in my article.
So bottom line, how do you think this generation stacks up?
You know, it's weird. It's weird to compare generations and think about, they're just different in some ways. I don't know. I mean, I guess the greatest generation was awesome, and then we're supposed to compare.
They were the greatest. I mean, clearly.
They're the greatest. I think that's where this idea of comparing, because I don't know if people, first of all, everyone who's older is going to think the younger generation sucks. And the generations older than them suck, too. So that's just, so when you get into this comparison kind of stuff, that's when this is kind of useless. So I guess I'm one generation older, so I'm going to think that you guys suck. That's how I started the article, which is like, I can't believe I'm about to say bad things about a generation younger than me, just like my parents did.
But you had data.
But I had data. I really did. Still felt awful. So I was trying to be self-aware of that when I wrote the article. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, things change so fast. I mean, Generation X was this, definitely had an ironic, laconic attitude, but the whole grunge flannel thing really changed. I bet the greatest generation wasn't so great before World War II and the Depression. So it really depends what happens and how the generation reacts to that. So I don't know. They're different. That's all I can tell. There's a lot of good and there's a lot of bad mixed in with that. Generally, I believe in progress. So I believe in general things are getting better and nicer. The new movie, Spike Jonze's new movie, Her, really gets at how things are getting nicer and people are getting nicer, but people are a little more lonely and disconnected. I think at least that movie seemed true in that way to me.
Well, Joel Stein, columnist for Time Magazine, thank you so much for taking this time for us.
This was fun. Thanks.
And we still have three millennials here with us, Scott and Katie Curry, who are married and 28 years old, and Ashley, who's 25. And I have to call you guys out. So during that interview, we all immediately decided, Katie, I think you started it. Instagram time.
No. Yes, I did. I absolutely did.
And Ashley, you as well?
I had to follow suit.
So a perfect example. You know, we're literally talking through how we, you know, are just like attached to our phones and have this thing. And you know, as we're listening to this conversation, we're Instagramming.
Can't help it.
I think it's just one of the things that we have that's different than the previous generation is that we have the capability to share these experiences instantly. So part of me wonders, is it that we're more narcissistic and self-involved, or is it just that we sort of have this constant running time machine that we have access to?
Right.
Whereas the boomers, you know, if they wanted to share an experience, they were, you know, printing film and taking slides and, you know, inviting people over for dinner in a slide reel.
Which would be, I think, way more obnoxious than just scrolling through someone's
right.
Facebook page.
Yeah, yeah.
And also, I wanted to point out just really briefly here, Scott, what text did you get just recently from your sister?
So just when Joel was talking about, you know, millennials being fame obsessed, my sister texts to give me a hard time and says, "Oh, you're so famous, you're on Instagram."
All right, we have to take a short break, but we'll keep this conversation going after. You're listening to Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
It's 9:40, and you're tuned to Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Great Outdoor Provision Company, celebrating Take a Child Outside with donations from Patagonia Footwear, inspiring a new generation of environmentalists. More at greatoutdoorprovision.com. And from Audi of Charlotte, presenting a selection of luxury vehicles committed to customer service and satisfaction. East Independence Boulevard, inside the 485 Beltway. Audi, truth in engineering. Information at audiofcharlotte.com. Coming up at 10 on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the Friday News Roundup. Presidential advisors recommend the NSA not be allowed to collect and store Americans' phone data. The Senate approves a two-year budget deal, and outgoing Fed Chair Ben Bernanke says the stimulus program will gradually end next year. That's the Friday News Roundup on the Diane Rehm Show on 90.7 WFAE. We're coming back to more discussion about the millennial generation in just a moment.
As 2013 draws to a close, we want to thank you for listening to and supporting WFAE. Please make your tax-deductible investment now to support the programming you'll enjoy next year. Call right now at 704-549-9000 or pledge online at WFAE.org. Make your investment by midnight, December 31st, and you'll automatically be entered to win a MacBook Air. No contribution is necessary to enter, but we hope that you'll support WFAE.
This is Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Michael Tomczyk in for Mike Collins. We've been discussing the millennial generation, those born between the early 80s and early 2000s. We still have three millennials here with us, Scott and Katie Curry, who are 28 and married and urban planners, and Ashley, who's 25. You can also join the conversation at WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks. Of course, we encourage tweets and Facebook posts. It is, after all, a show about millennials. But a little bit ago, we heard from the Time Magazine columnist who wrote the cover story on the millennial generation. And one of the details in there was how we now have, like, all of these photos of ourselves and our pets. So time to fess up. And I'm looking at you, married couple.
Uh-oh.
How many photos do we have of ourselves and our pets in our house?
We don't have any pets. But in our house, we probably have more family pictures in general, like his family, sisters, parents, and same with me. We do
have a photo wall behind our couch, and I'm trying to think. We've got some engagement photos, but I think most of them are places we've been to. So maybe we're more innocent than most.
Yeah, more pictures of places we've traveled and a couple of our engagement pictures.
And Ashley, I know you have dogs. So
I do have dogs. I think my apartment consists of a picture of me and my best friend, my family, and I have a picture of my dogs. So I have three.
Oh, not bad. Okay, so you're 1950s style.
Yeah, I'm throwing it back.
and selfies, because this is one thing where I'm going to be honest. I'm kind of a curmudgeon about this. I think they're ridiculous. But if you do it, tell me what selfies.
No.
No, not fans.
Absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
I mean, there's different places for it. I think we were talking about over the break, Snapchat when you're bored at work or
and
wherever.
Snapchat's basically you can send a photo that disappears after, what,
right.
10 seconds?
Right. And if that, you're just being silly and I take a picture of myself, draw a bunch of random stuff on it and send it to my sister. But I never take a picture and post on Instagram of just myself, like with duck lips or something. I've never done that and I will never do that.
Yeah, that's part of the millennial stereotype that I guess I just don't identify with that. I don't know.
Awesome. Ashley?
I think it is a little bit weird, to be honest. I think I took one of my Halloween hat, but there was nobody around to take it for me. So I am guilty of that one. Sorry, everybody.
Okay, and then text. I mean, I've seen different data that says we send an average of something like 88, 90 texts a day. How many texts do you guys think that you send every day?
I don't know. Maybe average or a little less, just because you're at work and I don't want to be seen on my phone at work all day. So I probably, while I'm at work, not as much, but probably average or a little below average.
Yeah, I don't have a sense of how many. I'll call out my sister again since we've already mentioned her.
She of course since got a text in the last segment saying that he's famous now and we're obsessed with fame. So it was another just great example.
Right. I remember first time my sister got a cell phone and we were doing the whole family plan thing, that my parents were just blown away that she could send 200 something texts a day. But you know, she's on that. I guess we're about as old as you can get and still be millennials. So I feel like part of our communication still identifies with the Gen Xers.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, my sister is a little bit younger and identifies maybe more with that internet mobile communication type of era.
Well, off that point, it is such a big generation. What do you think of the folks who are younger in it? You know, of the middle schoolers and high schoolers who are technically, Ashley, you're laughing, who are technically part of the same generation.
Yeah, I mean, I laugh at it because I know older generations sit there and scratch their heads at us, but we can still look at the younger, you know, millennials and have no idea what's going on in their heads, what they're doing.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Katie.
I was just going to say, we're both youth advisors at our church for middle schoolers. So we see firsthand the amount of time they're on their cell phones. And it does blow my mind because it does make me feel old because they're just connected to their phones the whole time. And it seems like they are. So that's a total difference between me and that generation. I'm agreeing with Ashley on that point.
A friend of mine actually gave me a great example the other night of how she knows someone who's in high school who repeatedly breaks up with his girlfriend and then gets back together via text message. It all happens via text as opposed to even a phone call or meeting in person. I mean, would any of y'all consider that to be an acceptable acceptable way to end a relationship?
Oh, no.
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 So there's an example. Are there any other things that stand out as far as, you know, I guess, as Joel Stein from Time said, every generation thinks the younger one sucks?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I agree. But, I mean, you know, it's just the age gaps and maturity levels, and we realize, you know, what's acceptable and what's not. I'm sure at some point when I was in high school that happened. But although we weren't really texting and stuff as much, so right. That makes me feel a little bit old now.
Yeah, I think there is a difference, at least maybe in our age group, maybe mid to late 20s. I mean, we grew up, there was a point where we didn't have internet. We didn't have cell phones. So we had that part of our lives that, you know, we still had to write a paper based on books from the actual library, and we didn't have the internet. So I think that contributes a lot to kind of our, that subgroup of the millennials that still have that kind of foundation of no internet and no cell phones.
Well, in true point, so we got a call from, excuse me, from Carl, who said, the amount of photos millennials take probably says more about the prevalence of technology than narcissism. And you know, this idea that, all right, so if everybody in the 60s had iPhones, you know, would there be any difference to what they were putting out as compared to what we're putting out today? What do you guys think?
Oh, I don't think there would be much difference at all. I mean, you stick an iPhone in front of anybody, you've got so many things you can do. I'm looking at mine right now. I'm like, oh, you know, this is kind of amazing when I think about it. But, you know, you'd have to be carrying around a lot of gear to do that back in the day.
I read an article, and it may actually have been Joel's article, but he said, you know, if you had given the boomers Instagram and Facebook and iPhones, how many terrible pictures of Woodstock would you have had?
Yeah, that was Joel's article. Well, and also the idea that, so now that everyone has access to this technology, I mean, I know a lot of parents and grandparents who are all about Facebook now. I mean, do you guys see that too? I mean, my Facebook feed is as much, you know, like my family members, like aunts and uncles and grandparents, as it is people who are our age.
Yeah, I see that. My parents are not on Facebook. I mean, they're definitely very savvy with the internet. My grandma is on Facebook, she says she just gets on it to see pictures of her grandchildren and her children, which I totally get. But I definitely see that. We were talking about it over the break, that I feel like the Facebook interest is kind of shifting away from us. We're not as interested in being on it as older generations are kind of getting their hands on it now.
Well, maybe it's because we have no attention span. So it's like, oh, we had this fascinating thing. It's not fascinating anymore. And the older folks are like, oh, look at this, Facebook. Yeah. What is it? Okay, and I've got, Katie, I've got to call you out on this. So you had this great story about how even though older folks are getting used to using this type of technology, they may sometimes still get the phrases wrong.
Oh my gosh.
A little bit. So what did your dad?
Yeah, so I was at home one night and I had my iPhone out on the kitchen counter. And I had this Twitter update. My phone made a noise, and he asked what that was. And he's like, whose phone is that? And I said, oh, it was mine. I think it was a Twitter update from one of my friends. And he said, oh, what's her hash brown?
And that
was my dad. Instead of hashtag, and we just laughed for a long time and still obviously give him a hard time about it.
All right, so we've created a new hashtag, and it's going to be hashtag hash brown.
Right.
Anyone following along with us, feel free to tweet away. We got another email from a listener that fits with what we're talking about right now. Given how much you are connecting with friends and family through texting and social media, do you actually feel more connected to these people?
Go ahead.
That's a good question, because a lot of the tweets and texts and Facebook stuff is pretty superficial, but I feel like the more deep and connective conversations are still very much face to face, at least in our friend group and with family. I feel like that's still the case.
Yeah, I mean, I've told a lot of my friends who've don't live in Charlotte, and it's hard to keep in touch with. I do know most about their lives and what they're doing through Instagram. I mean, I know that they went on a trip where they got a puppy, or they this and this and this. And I mean, I like that's kind of quick. You kind of get snapshots of what they're doing. And, of course, a phone call every now and then is always good.
So it's a way to follow, but not necessarily to, like, deeply connect.
Right.
Yeah.
Ashley?
I totally agree. And, you know, you can kind of keep up with somebody that you maybe haven't seen in a few years, and you can pick up right where you left off with them.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you haven't missed this huge gap in their life. You can still, like, keep up and, you know, move forward, have your meaningful conversations face-to-face. Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah.
Another thing I'd like to discuss with you guys is how we think about family and starting our own. So, Scott, when did you figure out that, okay, I need to marry Katie?
The moment he met me.
Yeah, right. That's a great question. I moved down to Charlotte because I knew that I wanted to marry Katie. And that was, that was a big part of my whole job search and trying to figure out where I wanted to be. But, you know, we have kind of an interesting story. We met at an urban planning conference when she was at grad school in Clemson and I was at University of Michigan. We met at the American Planning Association conference in Las Vegas and then dated long distance for 2 years. Sort of throughout that time realized that, you know, this is the direction I wanted my life to go. And, she got a job in Charlotte. So it was just sort of a foregone conclusion. Well, obviously I need to figure out a way to get down there.
And how old were you guys, you know, at this point when you were looking to move down to Charlotte?
25.
Let's see. I would have been, yeah, right around 25.
And then how old were you when you got married?
26.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what did you guys think of the age at which you were getting married?
I was very comfortable with it. You know, you kind of went through school, you know, had got your some socializing in college and grad school. I just felt the time was right for me. I was ready.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I've heard statistics that millennials are getting married older. So I don't know where we fall on that curve, but I didn't feel like it was too soon or too late. I mean, it just sort of was what it was. It was the right time.
And how common are marriages among, you know, the people that you know that are your age?
Pretty common.
Yeah, I think we've got friends that are we hang out with a lot of single folks, and we've got plenty of couple friends who are married or are about to get married. So,
and Ashley, how common is it among, you're a couple years younger? How common is it among the people that you know?
I mean, I think it's a pretty mixed bag. I do have a lot of friends that are married now or engaged, but still quite a few single friends. So, I mean, it's really kind of middle of the board there.
And what do you think of the idea of, like, you know, all right, at some point, am I going to start my own family?
Well, I'm sure someday, but, you know, I think it comes with the timing. I haven't met anyone that I feel like I need to marry.
Clearly a big step.
I think that could be an important factor there. Maybe. I'm not in any rush. You know, I'm enjoying myself. I can barely afford two dogs. So, you know, a family could be, you know, down the road a little bit.
Scott, you're nodding vigorously here. It was part of the initial, a challenge or something getting used to, like the way it shifts your financial life?
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, I don't want to be too stereotypical, but maybe it's more of a guy perspective to want to feel like you have roots down and settled and financially secure before you jump into that decision to have a family. I definitely feel that.
One thing I kind of wanted to transition to a little bit here that I think is another kind of fun difference is music. So as an example, we have just completely different types of music. I know that each generation kind of has this, but for us, I feel like the biggest thing that older folks can't seem to understand is like dubstep and electronic dance music, that kind of stuff. So and if you don't know what that is, so basically you have DJs who are like mixing using computers. Ashley, I know that you listen. You want to help me explain this a little bit?
Let's see. It's hard to explain anything to
a lot of bass, just like big
them on right now. We can make a little party in here.
But at the same time, so one of the big ways people our age like to go and hear this music and see this music is at festivals. And when you think about it, like, so yeah, festivals are huge now. But I mean, think like Woodstock was the biggest thing ever when that happened. So really, in some ways, it's a continuation of you know, how we have always approached music and tried to create these situations to meet in big groups and have something in common and enjoy. So have you guys been to any music festivals?
Oh, yeah.
Which have you been to?
Let's see. I just went to Mountain Oasis Festival.
Which is in Nashville, right?
Yeah, in Nashville. And it's a great time. You know, you got great people, good sense of community up there. I love Asheville. So it's just a good reason to get up there and just have some fun and meet a lot of people. And I made some friends during the trip. Before that, there were some smaller festivals. Let's see. Music on the Mountain. I don't know if they're still doing it. That's up near Boone. Floyd Fest in Virginia. All Good Festival. You know, there's quite a few, and I, you know, it's just a wonderful experience for me.
And Scott and Katie, what kinds of music do y'all like to listen to most?
Go ahead.
Gosh, I am the wrong person to ask about music. When it comes to music, I might as well be a boomer because I, you know, if it's been in the last, you know, 10 years that it's been released and Katie hasn't told me about it, then I probably don't know about it.
Well, that's a perfect example, though, because, I mean, it's, you know, it's not like every single one of us is putting on dubstep and just, like, losing our minds.
Some days.
People don't do that.
Is that normal? I'm into I'm kind of on the train of the folk music, Mumford & Sons, Alabama Shakes, I love all that, that trend is kind of coming back. That's where I am right now.
Excuse me. I've got a good question from Jack on our website. Was the education you received worth the price? And how did it prepare you for the current positions that you're in?
That's a really good question. I have no regrets if that's what the question is getting at. But if someday my kids are asking me, is it worth it for me to go to grad school and take on this much student loan debt? I think I would advise them strongly to look into all the alternatives available to them. I think I was attracted by Michigan because it was close to family and because it was a big name university and a top 10 program. But I think I probably could have gotten an education that served me equally as well somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I had an assistantship all throughout grad school, so I was very fortunate to have most of the tuition covered. But I think the amount of money that the tuition for at Clemson, it was absolutely worth it and prepared me well for my job now.
Last thing, just really quick. Do you guys feel like you're still figuring yourselves out? We'll do a power round. Ashley?
Yes.
Scott?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what do you think goes into that? Just briefly. I mean, just figuring out, you know, family, work, the whole everything?
Yeah. Family, friends, work.
Mm-hmm. Work for me, yeah. Just trying to figure out what my niche is and where I can make the most difference.
Well, Ashley, Scott, and Katie, thank you guys so much for joining us today. Thank you all for being part of the conversation as well. And I'd like to thank Charlotte Talks producer Aaron Kiever for putting the show together and making it so fun to be a part of. #baller.